We're going to take a short break for one of our sponsors. I haven't tried this one, but it looks well worth checking out if weight loss has been an ongoing challenge for you. Robody pairs medication options with diet and exercise modifications to achieve your desired goal. Before being prescribed any medication, patients complete an online medical visit, lab test, and more to see if you're right for their program. You can sign up online, which means no scheduling a doctor's appointment, no commute to the doctor's office, and no waiting rooms. Their data shows that average weight loss is 15 to 20% in 1 year with healthy lifestyle changes. BMI and other eligibility criteria apply. Go to ro.co/untangle. Sign up today and you'll pay just $99 a month for your first month and $145 a month after that. Medication costs are separate. That's ro.co/untangle. Now, back to our show.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Welcome to Untangle, the podcast from Muse, the brain-sensing headband that uplevels your brain health, and Meditation Studio, the 5-star app. Start the new year now by checking out choosemuse.com/meditationstudio to get hundreds of free meditations. It is a great way to infuse a little calm in this coming year. Today's guest is Gretchen Rubin, one of the most influential and thought-provoking observers of happiness, habits, and human nature. She's a highly acclaimed writer known for her ability to distill and convey complex ideas with clarity and humor. She's the author of many best-selling books, such as The Happiness Project, Better Than Before, and The Four Tendencies, which have sold millions of copies in multiple languages. Her most recent book is Life in Five Senses. She's also the host of the podcast Happier with Gretchen Rubin and has founded an app called the Happier App, which helps people track their happiness-boosting habits. To kick off 2024, we invited Gretchen to talk to us about how we can inject more happiness into our lives this year and how we can cultivate new habits with greater ease. She is pretty darn amazing. Now, here's Gretchen. Gretchen, I'm very excited to have you on Untangle today. It's such a pleasure. I've followed you for so many years, so it's very exciting.
Well, I'm so happy to have the chance to talk to you. Thanks for having me.
Can you share a little bit about your original inspiration for studying happiness and habits? What kicked you into gear with the original Happiness Project?
It was a very ordinary moment in my life. I was finishing up my book, my biography of John F. Kennedy. So I was finishing up a project. I had a little bit more open space in my head. I was stuck on a city bus in the pouring rain. And so I had one of these rare opportunities for reflection that we don't often get in the chaos of everyday life. And I thought, what do I want from life anyway? And I thought, I want to be happy. But then I realized I didn't spend any time thinking about whether I was happy, whether it's possible to make yourself happier. Were there things I could do to boost my happiness? And I thought, wow, this is really what I want from life. I should have a happiness project. And I ran out to the library the next day and got a giant stack of books about happiness, philosophy, science, memoirs, anything I could get my hands on. And at first, it was just for me. I just wanted to learn about what could I do in my own life, if anything, to become happier. But it's a subject that is so vast and so fascinating that I was like, wow, this should be my next book project. And I called it The Happiness Project because that's how the idea came to me. And then I've really been studying different aspects of it ever since. Like you said, I wrote a book about habit formation because that's very relevant.
I was reading that you weren't unhappy, but you called yourself like in a midlife malaise of some sort. Was that the impetus? You were finishing your book about John F. Kennedy, but were you feeling like, oh my gosh, what's next? What should I do with my life? I mean, was there any of that lamenting going on?
it was more about not appreciating my life. It was more like thinking, look, I have all the elements of a happy life and I'm just taking it all for granted and I'm not appreciating it. And it's so easy that we only really know what we have when we lose it or we fear that we might lose it. And I thought, I don't want to take this for granted. I want to live up to the level of, yeah, because when I started, I was pretty happy. And around the world, when you ask people, most people say they're either pretty happy or very happy. Most people are pretty happy. But there is this feeling like, but I think I could be happier. And I think if there's low-hanging fruit, let's grab it.
Let's grab it. What is happiness? Did you start with this definition of happiness or did it morph throughout your studies?
I started out my career in law. I spent an entire semester arguing about the definition of contract. And the definition of happiness is even more elusive. There are like 15 academic definitions of happiness. And what I realized is that for the average person, we can argue about it's peace, contentment, joy, satisfaction, well-being, or let's think about being happier. Whatever happiness looks like for you and for me, what would you do to be happier next week, next month, next year? What's moving you in the right direction? I think that that's just much easier to think about. And then also when people talk about being happy, it's, well, how would I get there? And how will I know when I'm happy? And how would I stay there? And that's just not very realistic. I think it's more about, are you moving in the right direction? So I think about, does something make me happier? And I don't really worry about defining that beyond that.
Yeah. You studied happiness. And then what changed for you where you were like, okay, I've got this. I'm going to write the book. I figured out what my happiness is.
For me, I write the book in order to figure it out. So I don't write the book once I figured it out. It's in the writing of the book. So I would just take just giant masses of notes. And then at a certain point, I'm like, well, let me organize my notes. And then I start organizing my notes. And then I'm like, I have my own take here. I got a hot take on this. Or I think everybody's getting that wrong. So I grope my way toward it. So it's really in the process of writing a book that I figure out what my conclusions are. And then by the end, that's when I write the book to know what I think.
That's so fascinating. So what were some of the misconceptions that you gleaned from your research on happiness?
One thing that I thought was maybe it was true for other people, but it wasn't true for me, which is the research shows that novelty and challenge tend to make people happier. We're happier when we're doing new things, when we live in an atmosphere of growth, when we're helping or building or learning. But I'm a person who loves familiarity and mastery. So I thought, well, maybe for most people, novelty and challenge make them happier, but that's not true for me. But as part of it, just doing the research for the book, the idea for the book is I'm the guinea pig. I try all these theories on myself and see what works. So I thought, well, I have to try that theory on myself, even though I don't think it's true. And then what I found is, oh, it is true. That doing novel and challenging things makes people happy, even when they're familiarity and mastery lovers like me. So that's really true. That was something where I went into it thinking, I don't agree. And then I came out of it thinking, I do agree.
Yeah, there's an exhilarating sense to novelty and challenge.
And also because it's new, time feels slower, life feels more rich. We're often broadening our identity of each other. I will say, on the other hand, that I do think that people often overlook the power of repetition and familiarity. I think that they also have their own power. One of the things I did for my book, Life in Five Senses, is I decided to visit the Metropolitan Museum every day for a year, every day that it was open, that I was in town. And I did that. That was years ago. And I still go every day because for me, going every day, and of course, I'm incredibly fortunate that I have the time and the freedom and I live within walking distance of the Met. And every single day, I think about that, how lucky I am. But the fact that I could do it doesn't mean that I would do it. For years, I'd hardly ever visited the Met. And now I visit every day and it's completely different doing it every day. And I've talked to a lot of people who have things that they do every single day. So there's power in repetition and familiarity, and there's power in novelty and challenge. They're both important.
Are you trying to become an expert in something when you go? Do you have a goal when you go to the museum every day, for example? What are you trying to achieve?
My goal is to have no goal. I'm a very goal-oriented person. And so I wanted to give myself recess. I wanted to give myself time to wander, to explore. So I go, and sometimes if I read about an artwork in a book, which I often will, then I'm like, I'll go look at it myself. And so that's fun. Or Pantone just announced their color of the year. Let me go all around the Met and see where I can spot that color. Can I anticipate where I would find it? Maybe there's a new exhibit. I'll go visit that. I have my favorites. I'll go visit my favorites. I'll want a certain atmosphere. So like my nerves are jangled. So I want to go someplace like really quiet. So I go to places that I know are really quiet, or there's a place that I haven't visited in a while. And I'm like, what's going on in that gallery? But I just try to keep it very open. One thing I have never done in all these years is listen to an audio guide. Because for some reason, I know I would probably enjoy the museum more. The more you know, the more you notice, and I'm sure I would appreciate the artworks, but it's just not the vibe that I'm going for there. I want to just be thinking my own thoughts and wandering around. So for me, a lot of it is scheduling time to wander and daydream and be free.
You are so lucky. That is one of the most magnificent museums in the entire world. And I could see how you could wander in different directions. And I interviewed a researcher from Germany who studies the science of happiness. And he says there's a happiness U-curve, that people are happiest at a certain age. And that age, according to his research, was 69. So I was curious.
I don't know about that researcher, and I haven't looked at that data. But I will say that there is research where people were talking about what times of life people were happiest. When you really pushed the research, they did things like controlling for marital status and health. The problem is, because they're like, oh, people are surprisingly happy when they're older. It's, yeah, if they're healthy and they still have their loving spouse with them. But the reason that a lot of people think that maybe it's harder to be happier when you're older is because they think it's probably more likely that you might have health problems and you might be alone. When people start talking about age, I'm like, okay, but what are you looking at? Are you controlling for the things that most people would associate with times of life? So if you say age 30 is an unhappy time, but is that because people have young kids and young kids are really different? Anyway, so I think you really have to poke under the hood with that kind of thing and see what are they actually looking at when you're looking at age-related things.
Gotcha. So what are the things and or characteristics that make us happiness? You've mentioned a few. You mentioned novelty and mastery and familiarity. And you talk about that you recommend people come to self-awareness because that helps them be more in alignment with their happiness choices or the things that they do. But what are some of the things that yield happiness? For those of us that want to be happy in 2024, what can we do?
Ancient philosophers and contemporary scientists agree, if you had to pick one element, what is the secret to a happy life? You would say relationships. To be happy, we need strong, intimate bonds. We need to feel like we belong. We need to be able to confide. We need to be able to get support. And just as important for happiness, we need to be able to give support. And so in 2024, anything that you do with your precious time, energy, or money that broadens your relationships, so it's helping you make new relationships, or deepens your relationships, so it's connecting you more deeply to the people you're already connected to, is something that's going to make you happier. So as you're thinking about, should I go to that reunion? Should I plan that party? Should I show up to that party? Should I visit my friend's new baby? Should I travel to go to that networking event? Should I start a book club? Things that deepen or broaden relationships will probably make you happier. Should I text in my family group chat every day? It's like, yeah, that's one thing to start. Another thing a lot of people overlook is to think about your body and your energy, because our physical experience always colors our emotional experience. And so if you are consistently not getting enough sleep, if you don't get any exercise, if you let yourself get too hungry or too thirsty or you're too cold or too hot, these things, they wear down our energy, they make us irritable, they wear down our patience. And the thing is, when you have energy, then you can ask more of yourself. So you're like, oh, should I plan that party that I know will make me happier? Yes. Should I plan that trip? Yes. Should I run that errand that's going to make my life a lot easier today? Or should I put it off? Oh, why don't you just go ahead and do it today? When we have energy, that's so much easier. But when we lack energy, even things that would otherwise be fun feel overwhelming and impossible. So beginning with energy is often makes all those other things that you try to get yourself to do easier.
Yeah, such a great point. You talk about other things like mindfulness and gratitude. You already talked about relationships, passions, and self-reflection, which we just talked about a little bit, self-awareness and personal growth. How did those influence our happiness levels? And also want you to talk a little bit about mindfulness, because I think I've heard on several podcasts that you do not meditate. But I wanted to understand, it sounds like you do a ton of contemplation and you have your own practices for settling what you call what your Yankee mind.
Mm-hmm.
So will you share a little bit about that?
Well, on the meditation front, twice I have tried for months where I'm like sitting, meditating. Twice, didn't work. Then a friend of mine who's a meditation teacher invited me to go on a silent meditation retreat. Third try, I was meditating and I was doing an unguided meditation for 45 minutes, silent meditation, after having done the silent retreat. And it was a very interesting and useful experience, but it's not a practice that works for me. No tool fits every hand. And I think it's a good example of just because other people tell you, oh, you have to do it, you have to do it. If it doesn't work for you, if you don't find that it is something that is helping you to achieve your aim, try something else. So for instance, I go to the Met because I need to let my mind off the leash. That's what I feel like I need. And the Met is exhilarating to me for just that free open time. And for whatever reason, meditation doesn't really bring me what it seems to bring other people. And so one tool works for me, but another tool doesn't. So just mindfulness is being aware of what we're doing and why, and whether we want to be doing it at all. So I think about mindfulness all the time. It's hard, surprisingly challenging, but it's really like thinking about, am I living up to my values for myself? Am I doing what I want? Am I not doing what I don't want? And finding all kinds of surprising things. And this is the thing about self-awareness. It's, you think, how do I not know myself? I just hang out with myself all day long. But here's something. I think I discovered this when I was writing my book, Happier at Home. I don't think it was in that, or maybe it was For Better Than Before, which was my book about habit change. But at some point, I realized that there are abstainers and moderators. So abstainers are people that when they are faced with a strong temptation, it's easier for them to give up something altogether. And they are all or nothing. They can not have it pretty easily, but once they start, they go all the way. And moderators are people, when they're faced with a strong temptation, do better when they have a little bit, or they have it sometimes. And they get panicky and rebellious if they're told that they can never have something. And realizing that I'm an abstainer was so freeing for me. So like, I've always in my whole life had a very, very strong sweet tooth. And if you have a very strong sweet tooth and you want to eat healthily, it's very demanding because you're like, now, later, one, two, three, I deserve it. It's my birthday. It's just this very boring noise in your head. And then I just had this realization. I'm like, I could just stop eating sugar. And I basically gave up all carbs. I eat a very, very low carb diet, which I love because as an abstainer, I'm just free from all that chatter in my mind. And cravings and things that had always been weighing me down. It's like, oh, and a friend of mine said, well, what's life without eating a brownie? And I'm like, not eating a brownie makes me happier than eating a brownie ever did. And I'm not saying that's true for everyone. I'm not saying that this is the magic answer for everyone. If you're a moderator, this isn't going to work for you. But like, I'm a moderator about wine because I don't really care about wine. I can have half a glass. I often will have like a third of a glass of wine. And a friend of mine said, for me, it's no wine or four glasses. There's no in between. So again, it's knowing yourself and what works for you. But if you've been trying and trying to be moderate, try abstaining. Because I'm always like, abstaining is so, if you're an abstainer, it's so much easier to abstain than to be moderate. And people just don't understand that. Because moderators keep telling us, don't give it up altogether. That'll make you bonkers. Yeah.
No. I like it when it's black and white. You don't have to labor over the decision.
That's exactly what it is. There's no decision. And what people don't realize is the decision itself even vanishes. There's no decision at all. The decision doesn't even present itself. So all that just goes away. This is the thing that I learned when I was writing my book, Life in Five Senses, though. So in Life in Five Senses, I was studying our sensory environment. And this was something that had puzzled me for years, ever since I found out I was an abstainer. I thought, because people would say to me, but there are all these food cues all the time. There's all these sweet smells as you walk through the airport. You're on social media. You see all these luscious desserts. Like you're walking through the grocery store. There's all these packages. It's always clamoring. How is this not distracting to you all the time? And I thought, why isn't it distracting to me all the time? I mean, I am a person who has an incredibly strong sweet tooth. So it's not like that stuff doesn't appeal to me. And yet I hardly notice it. Why? And then I realized when I was doing Life in Five Senses, the brain is always editing. The brain is not an objective reporter. The brain is telling Gretchen what Gretchen needs to know and moving the stuff that Gretchen doesn't need to know into the background. And like, I can't smell my apartment the way other people smell it because I smell it all the time. So my brain moves that, just takes that smell right away. That's true for everyone. You can't smell your home the way a guest smells it. And with the sweet smells and the sweet sights, my brain is like, Gretchen, this is like an advertisement for dog food for you. You don't need this information. We're going to move it back. It's there. If you look for it, you'll see it, but it's not going to be thrust into the front of your mind. And so I'm like, I am literally experiencing a different airport than my friend who can't resist Auntie Anne's, because her brain is being like, Auntie Anne's, Auntie Anne's, Auntie Anne's. And my brain is like, nah, who cares?
These things may be simpler for you because this is the work that you do and you're in this space of exploration and navigating change. But for other people that aren't as self-aware, how do they come to those decisions? How do we know ourselves? How do we build our self-awareness so that the decisions that you're making for yourself are easy for us too?
The whole point of my work is it doesn't really matter what I do. I'm just like an example of what somebody doing. All my work is about, well, what would you do? It's like, yeah, what would you do? How would you do it? That's the point of what I write about, is I'm always trying to be like, how do you figure it out for yourself? Because I'm not saying that my way is the right way. I'm saying it's just an example of what one person did, but it's always about what you would do. So that is the critical question. The crucial question is for me, because we're all unique, exactly like everybody else. How would I know myself? How would I do it for myself? So there's just countless ways. There's all sorts of know yourself better questions about how do I understand myself? How would I do it? I think one of the most important things that you can know if you're trying to keep your resolutions for yourself, keep your promises to yourself, maintain your healthy habits, is knowing your tendency. So when I was writing my book about habits, I realized that there was really this way that people fall in these four very distinct categories of upholders, questioners, obligers, and rebels. When you know your tendency, you know a lot about yourself, but in particular, you know how to set yourself up for following through with a resolution, with some promise that you're trying to keep to yourself. It also matters with a whole bunch of other stuff as well. But that's how I stumbled across this aspect of human nature. And I can explain the four tendencies, or I can just say, go take the quiz and find out what you are, and all will be revealed if you go to GretchenRubin.com/quiz. It turns out that when you know your tendency, you really have a big insight into how to do the things that are going to make you happier.
Yeah. As it relates to happiness and our ability to know ourselves better, let's talk about it now, because I think it's an important framework. And I wasn't sure I understood it until I put it in the context of our expectations for ourselves and for other people. So I was excited to have you walk us through these different tendencies and how they exhibit themselves in different situations.
Okay, so I'll give a quick overview of it, and then you can tell me what you are, because I can't wait to find out. And then we can talk about how a person would use that information to make themselves happier, healthier, more productive, more creative. So as you said, what the tendencies look at is how you meet expectations, or how you consider expectations, which sounds very boring, but ends up being really, really juicy. So we all face two kinds of expectations: outer expectations, like a work deadline, and inner expectations, like my own desire to keep a New Year's resolution. So whether you meet or resist outer and inner expectations, that's what makes you an upholder, a questioner, an obliger, or a rebel. So upholders are people who readily meet outer and inner expectations. They meet the work deadline, they keep the New Year's resolution without much fuss. They want to know what other people expect from them, but their expectations for themselves are just as important. They tend to love to-do lists, schedules, calendars. They're very focused on execution. Their motto is, discipline is my freedom.
They get things done.
Well, all four tendencies can get things done, but under different conditions. But upholders are particularly good at that. And I say that as an upholder. Yes, that's true. So questioners question all expectations. They'll do something if they think it makes sense. So they resist anything arbitrary, ineffective, unjustified. They're making everything an inner expectation. If it meets their inner standard, they will do it no problem. If it fails their inner standard, they will push back. So they have to understand why they're doing something. So their motto is, I'll comply if you convince me why. Then there are obligers. This is the biggest tendency for both men and women. You either are an obliger or you have many obligers in your life. Obligers readily meet outer expectations, but they struggle to meet inner expectations. These are the people who say, why can I keep my promises to other people, but I can't keep my promises to myself? Why is it that I can't make myself a priority? Why don't I take time for self-care? These are all obliger statements. So if an obliger wants to meet an inner expectation, they need to create a system of outer accountability, which is very straightforward. It's not always easy, but it's straightforward. So I want to read more. I join a book group. I want to exercise more. I work out with a trainer. I work out with a friend who will be really angry if I don't show up. I take my dog for a run, who's going to be really disappointed. I raise money for a charity. I think of my duty to be a role model for other people. All these are forms of outer accountability. And that is what an obliger needs. They are the people who are the most likely to come through when someone else, like a neighbor or a coworker or family member or friend, needs a hand. So their motto is, you can count on me. and I'm counting on you to count on me. And then finally, rebels.
I just want to ask a question about the obliger. Are they people pleasers?
That's a fascinating question. They often say they are people pleasers, but the fact is they are like, why do I behave the way that I do? It must be that I want to please other people. It's not about pleasing them. It's about the outer accountability, which sometimes takes that form. But I've talked to many obligers who aren't people pleasers at all. They only do something if they're going to get in trouble if they don't. So that is not the essential thing. It's like an explanation for the pattern, but that's not necessary. All that is necessary, like, because an obliger could be like, I'm a salesman who gives 110%. You think I have time to exercise? You think I have time to eat right? No, I don't. Because I'm all about making that sale. That's an obliger. And he might be a people, whatever. So people pleasing is often associated with it, but it's not necessary. And then rebels, which is the smallest category. Rebels resist all expectations, outer and inner alike. They want to do what they want to do in their own way, in their own time. They can do anything they want to do that they choose to do. But if you ask or tell them to do something, they are very likely to resist. And typically they don't tell themselves what to do. Like, they don't sign up for a 10 a.m. spin class on Saturday because they think, I don't know what I'm going to want to do on Saturday. And just the idea that somebody's expecting me to show up is going to annoy me. So their motto is, you can't make me and neither can I. So they're the smallest tendency. My tendency, upholder tendency, only slightly larger. Those are like the two extreme personality types. Obliger is the largest, and then questioner.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think you are?
I have to take a little test on your website, but I think I might be a questioner.
Yeah.
I just recently had, I tore my rotator cuff and I went to see a surgeon, and a surgeon always says surgery, surgery, surgery. And I was like, no, this can't be right. Well, I left his office saying, I'm going to get surgery. And then my brain went, no, you need to do research. You need to talk to other surgeons. You need to talk to non-surgical orthopedic people. You need to talk to alternative regenerative medicine people. Like, so I went in and started researching everything and then came out with my own conclusion that I'm not going to do surgery, but I had to question everything. And there was actually one person that said to me, you need to stop collecting information because...
Okay, you definitely sound like a questioner. Again, like, if people want to take the quiz, it's gretchenrubin.com/quiz. 3 million people have taken the quiz. But people will often say to questioners, you're asking too many questions, especially questioner children get that a lot. But also, here's the thing. It sounds like you might have fallen into analysis paralysis, which is a thing for questioners where sometimes their desire for perfect information makes it hard for them to make a decision or to move forward. So that's a really useful... This is a good example. So sometimes questioners will be like, well, I really want to get into an exercise routine, but should I do high intensity weight training, or should I do cardio, or should I do interval, or should I do CrossFit? And so there's ways to, if you know that you're falling into analysis paralysis, or you're working or living with somebody who's in analysis paralysis, then you can say, oh, this is a very common thing. What are the strategies to end analysis paralysis? And then you're like, and that's much easier than just trying to work on yourself. Once you see that you're part of a pattern and that there are many tools and strategies that other people have used that you can deploy, it just makes it much easier to figure out how to get out of.
We'll take a short break for one of our awesome sponsors, Born Shoes. I was so excited to try these cute casual sandals made with top quality leather, perfect for all the traveling that I do. They're so comfortable for walking anywhere. I know exactly why their tagline is "Take comfort in Born Shoes." Perfect. There are 5 new styles this spring, and I tried Ithaca and absolutely love them. But they also have boots and heels you should try. They feel as good as they look. Go to bornshoes.com today for a 15% discount plus ground shipping on all full price shoes when you use my promo code UNTANGLE. That's promo code UNTANGLE for 15% off and free shipping, available exclusively to our listeners for just a limited time. Now, back to our show. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. We all carry around different stressors, big and small. We talk about these often on Untangle. When we keep things bottled up inside, it can start to impact our health mentally, emotionally, and physically. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest, whatever it is. If this sounds like you, and it's a bit of all of us, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule and needs. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/untangle today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/untangle. Now over to untangle.
The situation, and if, let's say you want to exercise. If I know you're a questioner, I'm going to tell you something very different from what I would say if you were an obliger or you were a rebel or you were an upholder. And so this, back to the larger question, which is why does this matter if we want to make our lives happier? It's because a lot of times to make ourselves happier, we're trying to get ourselves to do something or to stop doing something. And when you know your tendency, you can just do that in a much more efficient way. I remember an upholder saying to me, I assumed I needed accountability, which it's a lot of time and energy and sometimes money to get accountability. If you don't need it, maybe you don't want to bother with it. So to an upholder, they don't really need the accountability, but to an obliger, it's essential. And if you know that about yourself, it's really, somebody said, I was like, why am I working out with a trainer? I could work perfectly well by myself. It's like, but if you need accountability, then that is key for you.
That's your thing.
That's your thing.
I'm just thinking, I asked my partner what he would do in my situation. And he said, I'd get the surgery. Like, he didn't even think twice. He was like, surgeon said, get the surgery. I think he's probably an upholder. What do you think?
You can't tell from that because I'd have to probe. But I will say, as an upholder myself, one of the downsides of upholders and why I think we need a lot of questioner influence in our lives, I'm married to a questioner, is that upholders too readily will do something because if they can, they will. And sometimes they don't question enough. Well, why should I? If you're the expert, you're telling me to do this. Okay, can I do it? Will I do it? When should I do it? Let me get it on the schedule. Let me get it on the calendar. Let me get it crossed off. Rather than being like, why am I doing this at all? Why am I listening to you? Is there a better way, a more efficient way? And so I will often channel my husband being like, why would you do that? Because I don't want to just automatically do something because I can get myself to do it. So again, it's, you know how to offset your weaknesses a little bit more. As an upholder, I'm very rigid about calendar things. And so I will know, let's say something comes up and I'm like, I really don't want to change my schedule. I really don't want to be flexible. And I'm like, this is your thing, Gretchen. Remember, you'll be happier if you change this around and that around and do it all instead of just saying, oh, I can't do that because something's always, I have a conflict.
Where do you have conflict with your questioner husband as an upholder? Or do you understand each other in such a way that it doesn't yield conflict?
One thing that's interesting is with every tendency, you tip one way or the other because they all overlap with each other. If you thought of a Venn diagram of four overlapping circles. So upholders are like questioners in that they readily meet inner expectations, but they're also like obligers because they readily meet outer expectations. And questioners are also like upholders because they readily meet inner expectations, but questioners are also like rebels in that they resist outer expectations. So I am an upholder who tips to questioner, and my husband is a questioner who tips to upholder. So we have a lot in common. So that, I think that makes it good. But the way we have conflict is if we RSVP to something, yes, I'm like, we're going. Because we said we were going to go. Whereas my husband, it's more like, why would we go? Like now, of course, he wants to be polite. If it was like a dinner party where somebody was cooking for us, he wouldn't question it. But you know, sometimes you go to a big event, like a big school event. It would never occur to me not to go. And he is really evaluating that. And I'm like, but we got to go. Fortunately for me, he's also very prompt. That's often a big conflict. Why should we get to the airport 2 hours early? He's like, why do we want to worry about it? So that works for me. Another thing is if he asks me to do something, I'll just do it. He doesn't need to tell me why. He's like, I need this address. I'm like, here it is. But I've learned with him, I have to explain why I'm asking him to do something. I need this address because I found out that he didn't get the email and I need to forward it to him. And he's much more likely to do it if he understands why. Whereas I don't need that. I'll do what he asked me to do. I don't have to understand his reasons. And in fact, sometimes I'm like, don't slow me down, man. I don't care why you need your ass. I'll just say,
you trust him.
It's not about trusting because it's not that he doesn't trust me. It's just he doesn't see why he would meet an expectation with it. He's like, why would I do that? He just always is thinking, why would I do that? Why would I take the time to look up that email? Why do I care? I don't care. It's not about trust. It's just about reasons, I guess.
And how did the four tendencies relate to habit change? And did you write better than before or after the four tendencies?
I was writing better than before, which is all about the 21 strategies we can use to make or break our habits. And I kept seeing these patterns that I couldn't make sense of. And maybe you'll identify with this as a questioner, because one of the questions I would ask people about habits is I would say, how do you feel about New Year's resolutions? Because this is just a way to get people talking about their habits. A good number of people would say, oh, I make resolutions, but I wouldn't wait for January 1st because January 1st is an arbitrary date. And that really surprised me because I'm like, the arbitrariness of January 1st never really bothered me, but clearly they're all using that word. So it's like, it's resonating with them. I remember once talking to a woman, she was like, what are you working on? And I said, I'm working on a book about habits. And she literally stepped backward from me, like in revulsion. And she was like, why would you ever want to write a book about such a horrible subject? And I was like, are you kidding? I love habits. To me, it's like energizing and exciting. This is why I decided to write a whole book about it. But she was like, I don't like to chain myself. And now I realize she's really one of my original rebels, because talking to her, she was such, now I know, a paradigmatic rebel. And I was just like, she sees the world in a completely different way from me. How do I understand this? Because how do I understand habit change? If some people object to the very idea of habits, they don't even aim for habits. Like to them, it's like a bad idea. So there were all these like little, the most important conversation I had was I was talking to a friend about her habits. And she said, the funny thing about me is I know I'm happier when I exercise. And when I was in high school, I was on the track team and I never missed track practice. But now I can't go running on my own. Why? I was like, why? That's a really important question. I'd heard a lot of people say things like that before. And so I had all these patterns as I was studying habits. And then all of a sudden, I was sitting right here at the desk, right where I'm sitting right this second. And all of a sudden, it was like the word expectations just came blaring out at me. Expectation. And once I realized there was outer and inner expectations and that there were people who were meeting it or resisting it, all these patterns that seemed completely unrelated suddenly made sense. And once you know these patterns, you will see them everywhere. They are so blatant. You and I could talk about the Game of Thrones characters. We could do the characters from The Office. We could talk about movies where there are exceptional examples of people living out their tendency. It's very easy to spot. In fact, for years, I was really worried. I can't be the first person who figured this out. Who figured this out first that I need to cite, dang it. And it's like, no, that's me. I'm the one who came up with it. But it grew out of trying to understand why people struggled in these different ways or didn't struggle in habit formation. But then it turned out it's much bigger than habits, but it's very relevant to habit formation.
Okay, so we're starting a new year, and this is not an arbitrary date. It's a beginning. How do people start to explore and then activate habit change using these models?
Well, it would depend on their tendency. So if you're an upholder, let's throw out a habit and we'll just use that as the example. What's a habit we should talk about?
Let's talk about eating healthy.
Okay, here we go. That is not a very good aim because it is too vague.
Yeah, it's too broad. Okay, you want something more specific.
What you want is something concrete and manageable. And you might even break this down into multiple things that you would track. We tend to manage what we monitor, so it's very helpful to know. At the end of the day, you should be able to say to yourself, yes, I did this, or no, I did not do this. Did I eat healthy today? I don't know, because some was healthy and some was not healthy. Overall, was it healthy? It's too vague. So you might say something like, I'm going to eat breakfast every day. I'm going to eat a salad for lunch every day. I'm going to cook for myself 4 nights a week. I'm going to quit sugar. I'm going to cook 1 new recipe a week. I'm going to go to the farmer's market every Saturday and buy fresh produce and then make sure that I eat it throughout the week. And some habits are not every day. It might be a weekly habit. It might be like as relevant or as presented. But you want to be like, at the end of the day, it's like, did I eat breakfast today? Yes, I did. Did I pack lunch and bring it from home? Yes, I did. Because you want to focus on actions, not outcomes. So eating healthfully is the outcome. So that's the same thing as like learning Italian. Today, did you learn Italian today? Probably not. But it's like, did you memorize 5 new Italian vocabulary words? Did you read an article in Italian? And did you watch a weekly movie in Italian without the subtitles on? These are things that a person would do to learn Italian. And yes or no, did I do that or did I not do that? And then you want to think about how to use your tendency to help you do it. Because let's say you're a person who goes to work still old school every single day and you want to bring lunch, a homemade lunch every day to work. You're like, okay, well, how would I create outer accountability around that? Interesting challenge, right? Obligers are always trying to think of inventive obliger things. I talked to some people in an office. There were all these obligers that wanted to eat healthfully. So they would take turns bringing in a big salad and then they would split it. So I have to make the salad on my day or my 2 coworkers don't have anything for lunch. And I have to eat a salad on the day that my coworkers bring in salad because they're going to be really annoyed if I order takeout when they hear they went to all this trouble to make a salad for me. Outer accountability. Or you could think of your duty to your future self. Like my future self is going to be really disappointed if I don't do this. You could think of your duty to be a role model for other people. You could say, I want to show my children what it looks like to commit to good health and to keep a promise to myself. And I know that they're going to be watching me. You could make a deal. Like if you have a sweetheart, you could make a deal. Hey, if I don't bring in a homemade lunch, then I will do XYZ thing that you would like me to do instead of you. that person's going to be watching because they'll be like, ooh, maybe I don't have to clean up after dinner tonight because somebody didn't bring in lunch or whatever. Somebody did something funny where she is like, if I ate dessert, my husband had to eat two desserts.
Oh, interesting.
Because she was like, that would not be good for him.
No.
He should do what he wants. Anyway, it was a funny thing. So there's all kinds of ways. So you would want to do that if you're an obliger. If you're a rebel, you would want to see outer accountability is often counterproductive for rebels because they want to do what they want to do. So rebels often think about identity. I'm a healthy-minded person who respects their body. Or I'm a person who loves flavorful, authentic food. And I don't want to eat out of like fast food and crisp in like crinkly packages. Like I only want the most flavorful and home cooked meal. Or they might challenge themselves. Like people say that I can't give up sugar for a whole year. Watch me. Or people say that I can't bring in a homemade lunch every single day for a year. I'll show you. And so they want to tap into that rebel tendency. And they often really benefit from spontaneity and like a lot of choice. So they would maybe want to tap into that. Upholders, it's like, set it and forget it. That thing's pretty easy for upholders. And the questioners, it's like, why am I doing this? And they might do a lot of research and they love efficiency and customization. So they might be like, this is all the money I'm saving. This is all the time I'm saving. This is the health benefits of it. This is how I'm going to get back into cooking, which I love, which I've gotten away. And this is going to be a way to bring that back into my life. Why this way? Why this often? Why am I doing this at all? Because often questioners, if you talk to people, are like, if you want to change your habits, you just have to get clear on your why. I'm like, the mere fact that you're saying that makes me think that you're a questioner, because that works really well for questioners. It doesn't work for the other tendencies. It's not that it's bad for the other tendencies, but it doesn't change their behavior.
I love this. And I think people need to get the book if they haven't already read Better Than Before. Does that include information about the four tendencies or?
So in Better Than Before, it's the 21 strategies that we can use. So there's the strategy of convenience and the strategy of scheduling, the strategy of treats and all the strategies. And the four tendencies is one of the strategies. But after Better Than Before came out, all anybody wanted to ask me about was the four tendencies. And like deeper and deeper and all these like very nuanced questions. And I was hearing all this stuff from people. I'm like, I got to write a book about the four tendencies. So the four tendencies is just about the four tendencies. And Better Than Before is about all 21 strategies.
And the strategies, as you're laying them out here, it's about being accountable and having clarity and knowing your external triggers or your loopholes. But it sounds like there are some specific things that we can do. Is your habit manifesto your Gretchen Rubin's habit manifesto, or is it something everyone could relate to?
Well, I think it's something everybody could relate to, but yeah, it's the manifesto that I wrote. Yeah. Some of the key things from my habit manifesto that I think are applicable to just about everyone is, well, one of the things we talked about, which is to focus on actions, not outcomes. So it's not write a best-selling novel. It's write 1,000 words a day. It's not get in shape. It's go for a 20-minute walk a day. Another one is what we do every day matters more than what we do once in a while. That's why it's good to make your resolutions manageable and realistic, because if you go for a 2-mile walk every day, that's going to be better for you than going on a 5-mile run every few months. So every day matters more than once. And it matters the other way too, which is if you eat healthfully most days, if every once in a while you don't, that doesn't really matter as much if it's what you do every day that's more significant. Here's an important one. It's easier to change our surroundings and our schedule than to change ourselves. It's easier to like make things easier or harder rather than trying to change your attitude. So a good example of this is I remember talking to somebody. He was like, here's where I need help. I need more willpower. And I was like, why do you need willpower? And he said, I need willpower because I'm in the car and I know how dangerous it is to text and drive, but I just can't resist. I keep picking up my phone and looking at it. And so like, how can I build up my willpower? And I'm like, don't worry about your willpower. Put your phone in the floor of the back seat and then you can't do it. That's much easier. That's much more straightforward. Like, put it in the trunk, put it in your glove compartment and don't allow yourself to try to reach for it. Change rather than trying to work on yourself. Or like, let's say you're trying to stop watching TV. Well, this is also two of the strategies that work really well are the strategies of inconvenience and convenience. So you want to make the manifesto item is you want to make it easy to do right and hard to go wrong. So let's say you're trying to watch less TV. Put your TV remote in a closet in a room that's very inconvenient to wherever your TV is. So you can't just plop down on the sofa, pull out the remote and start clicking around. You got to like walk over to the guest room, open up the closet door, reach down from the shelf and get it. It's not like you can't watch TV when you want to, but you've made it harder. And any research is hilarious. Any friction makes it harder for us to do something. And you want to do this with good habits too. Like I remember I've talked to a surprising number of people who sleep in their workout clothes because they're like, I just want it to be easier the next morning. I just sleep in that outfit so I don't have to change. I'm like, well, if it works for you, we manage what we monitor. We talked about that earlier. Like if there's something you want to change, monitor it. And here's an important one. And better than before, I talk about the strategy of treats, but they need to be healthy treats because you don't want to do something to make yourself feel better that in the end just makes you feel worse. So you want to have treats like maybe your healthy treat is a crossword puzzle or Wordle, or maybe I love smells. So I have all these perfume samplers and I'll just go smell a smell. And for me, that's a treat because you don't want to often we reach for things that don't make us feel good afterward, impulse shopping or an extra glass of wine or doom scrolling or whatever. So those are some of the habits.
I'm going to put the habit manifesto in our show notes so that people can see. And then hopefully that will give them some inspiration for creating new habits. There were two more things that I wanted to ask you about. And one is your 23 for 23 list. And then how you would advise us to put together our 24 for 24 lists.
Well, around the new year, there's all this talk about new year, new you, and making New Year's resolutions, which is great. But a lot of people, and I found this out when I was writing about habits, a lot of people don't have positive associations with New Year's resolutions. They're discouraged because they failed in the past or they don't like them. But we're more likely to hit an aim if we identify it. And so one of the things that I like to do is to do whatever the year is. So for 2023, I made a 23 and 23 list. I just write a list of 23 things that I want to do. And some are fun and some are arduous. Some are like things that I could do in an afternoon. Some are things that would be very taxing. And some are things that are a little bit more of a stretch. And then some are things that are more comfortable. But I've seen people make these lists, like sometimes people will have only things that are fun. Sometimes people will divide it into categories like work, family, friends. Sometimes people will do it with other people, like you'll have a mutual 23 for 23 and 23 list. There's no right way or wrong way, but for a lot of people, for some reason, this feels more fun, more possible, more practical than making New Year's resolutions. So it's a different way of thinking about, well, what do you want to change in 2023, 2024? And then keep track of it. And I also think for a lot of people, because there's a longer list, it's not like just a handful of resolutions. There's more of a sense that you're making progress because you're like, well, I haven't done everything, but look, it's May and I've already done six things. It's like I'm making progress. Where sometimes with New Year's resolution, there's that thing I call a determination day, but it's also called discouragement day, which is like this day in February where they're like, most people have abandoned their resolutions by now. So I think sometimes people feel like, well, I've blown it. I broke my New Year's resolution. Whereas with this list, it's like, hey, it's September.
I'll do it later.
Yeah, it's September. You got a long time to go.
I started my 24 for 24 list after hearing that you had recommended that. Have you done your 24 for 24? Are you in the process or what's your timeline for that?
I love doing it. And I had 45 and I keep shrinking and eliminating and adding and subtracting. So that's the fun of it is really thinking like, ooh, what do I really want to commit to? I'm in the final stages of coming up with my list. How about you? How's your list coming along?
I found myself in some ways tricking myself. Like I know I do strength training. So I wrote on the list, I'm going to do strength training twice a week, but I already know I'm going to do that. So I don't know if that's fair to put on there, like some throwaway thing. So I have to get very clear on, I put easier things like I want to go to Mexico City this year, or I want to read 3 books in the first 2 months. And I need to get clearer on what I want to do, but I have maybe a quarter of the list done.
Well, there's no right way or wrong way, but I'll say in my own experience. So for my book, Life in 5 Senses, I went to the Met every single day and I did that for a year and now I keep going. And so I had to visit the Met every day, but this year I didn't put it on because I'm like, that is truly now part of just my ordinary day. It's like walking my dog in the morning. I don't decide whether to walk my dog in the morning, so I don't put that on the list. But if it's something where you're like, I want to make sure that I keep this solid, like practicing guitar every day, that feels like something like it could be easy for that to slip away for most people. I don't know about you.
Yeah, definitely, definitely.
So if it's something that you really are like, I really want to make sure that I do not let this one go, because one of the things I found with habits is just because somebody has been doing something for a long time doesn't mean that sometimes they slip away faster than we realize.
Should it be a goal, or does that need to be more specific, just as an example for people? Should it be towards an end goal? Like, I want to be able to play this song by the middle of the year, or versus I'm going to practice?
Well, again, that's an outcome.
So we don't want to do outcomes.
You can't control an outcome. Like, you can't decide that you're going to be able to do it. But what you can do is you can say, now, it might be interesting to set yourself a milestone and be like, on July 2nd, which is halfway day, you might say July 2nd, something like, because I think sometimes people do like to have a miles. I think finish lines are very dangerous when it comes to habits, because when we finish, we have to start over. And a lot of times it's much harder to start over than even to start, which is often a very unpleasant surprise for people. But when you think of a milestone, that would be a very exciting milestone. Maybe you want to give yourself a milestone, or maybe you want to say, every month I'm going to try it and see, so you can have a way to measure your progress. Where it's very easy to focus on the to-do, but a lot of people really need a ta-da. They need to see progress. They need to see themselves. So you might say, at the end of every month, I'm going to try playing that song. And then as the year goes by, it would become easier and easier. And that might be exciting for you. And it would be a milestone. But you don't want to set it up for yourself. So the minute you play that, you're like, oh, I've achieved my goal. Now I can ease up on the guitar playing. And then in 6 months, you're basically right back where you started, because it's something where you really need to keep in the practice to keep that mastery. I would say use it as a milestone.
Okay, good. It sounds like there's a lot of nuances. So I think if people can look at your happiness and your habit manifestos, they'll get some more ideas of how they can do that for themselves. I want to congratulate you on the 15-year anniversary of the Happiness Project. And what has changed in your life since you wrote that original book? I know you've written many other books, but in your personal life, how have you changed?
Well, so many aspects of my life have changed. So my daughters are, like, a lot of times people think my daughters are the same age, which no, they actually grew up, they're growing. We got a dog, which was a huge happiness boost. One of the biggest things that's changed is that when I wrote the Happiness Project, there was this shadow over our lives, because my husband has hepatitis C, or he had hepatitis C, which he got from a heart surgery that he had when he was 8 years old. And yeah, hepatitis C is not good. It attacks your liver. You really, let us all love our livers and appreciate our livers. The liver is a magical organ. And so at the time that I wrote the Happiness Project, this was a huge ongoing concern. And in the book, I say, oh, doctors say that a cure is coming, but it's 5 years away or maybe longer. Well, as it turns out, the cure was 9 years away. But since that came out, my husband was cured. Thanks to science and researchers and doctors, he's now cured. And so that's just something that's lifted. It's amazing. So that's a huge thing. I celebrate that every year. Yeah, I've written a lot of books, but a lot of things are the same. I live in the same apartment. I'm married to the same guy.
Do you think you're happier than when you started?
That is a fascinating question. Everybody has an inborn temperament. And I did a test and I'm 7 on the 1 to 10 scale. And I think that's right. I am a pretty cheerful person. I'm about a 7. And I think when I'm lying in bed at night or I'm on the subway staring into space, I'm the same Gretchen. I'm a 7. But what's different is my experience of my life is so much happier. Like, I have so much more fun and enthusiasm and love and so much less guilt and remorse and anger and boredom. And I behave myself so much better, which was a huge thing I work on. And I've just been much better at making decisions. Now, if I'm trying to decide whether to do something, I use all the research and I use my experience and all these frameworks that I've developed. So I think just as I go through my day, my life is happier. But you say, like, have I profoundly changed my own nature? I don't think I profoundly changed my own nature, but I've changed my life. And when I change, my relationships change. I think my relationships with my daughters are much stronger than they would have been otherwise, just because I thought so much about what things I might do to keep those relationships strong.
Yeah. Thank you so much for all the amazing work that you have done. Is there anything else that you'd like to share as we're starting the new year? Anything in particular that we might have missed?
Well, one thing I would say is, remember, there is no one size fits all magical way to help ourselves to become happier, healthier, more productive, and more creative. Just because something works for your sister-in-law, just because your brother has really good results for something, if it doesn't work for you, it doesn't work for you. We can all reach the same aim, but we may have to take different roads there. And so it really is about what's right for you. And don't get discouraged if something works really well for somebody else and doesn't work for you. Or if something works for you that doesn't work for somebody else, don't be surprised. We all have to figure it out for ourselves.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you so much, Gretchen. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining today, and Happy New Year to all.
There's more info on Gretchen at gretchenrubin.com. Her books are available at all major booksellers. Check out choosemuse.com/meditationstudio for hundreds of free meditations. And thanks for all your great feedback this past year. And please continue to send us your ideas, suggestions, and comments. It means a lot to us. Have a great start to the new year, and we will see you next time.